It's a real privilege, actually, to be speaking to the Friends of the National Archives AGM. It's also, I'll be honest, a little daunting. And it's daunting for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm very conscious that your AGM speakers in the past have included a rather august line of historians and archivists. And as if that wasn't enough, I'm also well aware that there'll be many historians and archivists in the audience. And as will become abundantly clear over the next hour or so, I am not a historian or an archivist. I'm a photographer. So I feel slightly out of my depth. But what I'll try and do over the next hour or so is show you perhaps some different ways of approaching the way in which we might open up history to people who have otherwise found it a challenging or inaccessible subject, and also hopefully show you one or two sort of creative ways that I've been trying to use the material that's here in the National Archives. So I'm here to talk about this thing called the Remembrance Image Project, and your first question might well be, well, what's that all about? From what you may have seen in the excellent newsletter which Tony was talking about earlier, there was a little snippet about it earlier on in the year. You might have figured out, if you'd read that, that it's something to do with history, and particularly First World War history, and something to do with photography, and that's absolutely right. My job, as I say, is as a freelance photographer, but I have a particular interest in photographing historical subjects. That's involved quite a diverse range of things over the last few years. I photographed disused Battle of Britain airfields. I photographed Stockwell Bus Garage. Anyone ever visited Stockwell Bus Garage? Believe it or not, it's a listed building. It's an amazing piece of 1950s brutalist architecture, and it's still in use as a bus station. They have an open day coming up, my plug for them. I forget the date, but look, Google it, and you'll find amazing building. And I also run this thing called Secret London Photo Walk, where I take tourists and Londoners around London and tell them a bit about the history, but also help them to get slightly more interesting photographs than the usual tourist snaps. So I've got various ways in which I'm trying to combine photography with learning about history. And that's really the jumping off point for this project. And I suppose for me, the link between photography and history is that great pictures tell stories, whether it's stories about the ambition of politicians or the innocence in the eyes of a young child playing, the detail of some piece of design or architecture that catches your eye, the expanse of a vast seascape or the gritty griminess of a city scene at night, or even just the expansiveness of a Lakeland landscape, as in this picture. For me, what I love about great photographs and great pictures is that they tell stories, but also that they ask questions. They invite you to think, what's around the next bend? What's over the hill? What questions is this picture inviting me to speculate on? And of course, history, in my mind anyway, is a lot about that as well. It's about stories, but it's also about questioning. It's about reflecting. It's about thinking, what does this really mean? What's really going on here? And so for me, photography and history go together very, very well. And that's where the idea for this Remembrance Image Project came from. Most of the slides I'm going to show you tonight, as the name of the talk suggests, will be images. This is the most text-heavy slide I've got. But I wanted just to outline to you what this project is about. And it's very simple, because I'm a very simple person. It basically has three elements. The first thing I'm doing is that I'm photographing sites associated with the First World War at around about the time of their 100th anniversary. So that means I'm going to be pretty busy over the next few years, obviously. The pictures that I'm showing you tonight are ones that I've taken during the research phase of the project over the last 18 months to 2 years. And that might be sites abroad. Lots of what I'm going to show you tonight is in France and Belgium on what became the Western Front. But I'm also taking pictures in London, sites of military hospitals, sites of air raid damage. There are all sorts of things much closer to home as well. And I'm trying not just to create a record of what the place looks like, but to take photographs that somehow capture a little bit of the spirit or the emotion of the places which I'm photographing. So that's the first chunk. The second piece of work within the project is, I guess, a little bit of what I'm doing tonight, to use the images in presentations, workshops, seminars, with school groups, with community groups, with retirement groups. I'm doing a lot of presentations to the Women's Institute. I do workshops in secondary schools and primary schools, and using the images that I've taken as a way of promoting debate about the history of the First World War and inviting people to reflect on what remembrance might mean 100 years on from the events that we're commemorating. And the final chunk, and this is a call out to any photographers out there, is that I'm very keen for other people to create and share their own remembrance images. So if you are a photographer of whatever, you know, persuasion or interest, or you know anyone that is who might be interested in getting involved, then this might be a way for them to contribute something towards the commemoration of the centenary. And I'm lucky to be working as part of the Imperial War Museum's Centenary Partnership, which I'm 99% confident TNA is part of as well. I'm sure it must be. And many other thousands of organisations around the world. What, you might ask, has all of this got to do with the National Archives? Well, as I said at the beginning, I'm not a historian. When I started on this project, the last World War I history I'd done was my GCSE history, which is longer ago than I care to remember, so I had to gen up quite a lot. And of course I went to bookshops and libraries and bought books, but being a big fan of the archives, I wanted to come here and delve into some of the primary sources. And I'm just going to share with you three out of the many documents that I looked at that really inspired me. This is the first one. I always like documents that have "most secret" written at the top. It sounds very exciting. This is the minutes of the Cabinet Committee on War Policy from 1917. Now, 1917, I'm sure many of you are, as I say, are much more familiar with First World War history than I am, but it was not a great time for Britain and her allies. We'd had the Battle of the Somme and the Battle of Verdun the previous year, which had inflicted large numbers of casualties. The Germans were just starting unrestricted submarine warfare all over again. The Russians were descending into revolution, and we thought they were going to probably pull out of the war, which indeed they did by the end of 1917. In fact, pretty much the only thing looking good for the Allies was that the Americans were joining the war. But even the Americans were going to take about a year to get troops on the ground in any numbers. So 1917 is a pretty tough time for the Allies. And so Lloyd George convenes a cabinet committee to talk about war strategy. And this is the minutes and the final report of that meeting. And this is just an extract from it. I don't expect you to be able to read it, but on this page, Haig, the commander-in-chief of the British and Commonwealth forces in France and Belgium, is arguing for more troops to fight the Germans on the Western Front. Now, you might think that's a pretty obvious thing to be arguing for, but Lloyd George and lots of the other politicians didn't think that was a good idea. They thought the war would more likely to be won somewhere else, possibly in Italy or maybe in what was then Mesopotamia. So there was a whole political dimension going on behind the military dimension. And what's fascinating about this document is behind the report, which you can see here, are the minutes of those meetings. And they are the hand-corrected minutes. So the cabinet secretaries typed up the minutes, and then at the next meeting, Haig said, actually, I didn't quite say that. Or, oh, that's not quite what I meant. And you can see, inked in, the hand corrections which the secretary has made. It's a fascinating document for tracing the political to-ing and fro-ing at this crucial point of the war. And I want to try and capture some of that politics, as well as the military history, in what I'm doing. But the military history, of course, is really important too. And photography has the ability to help us decipher the land. It's only actually when you visit or look at the sites of battle that you start to understand some of the challenges. And I'll show you a few pictures later on that do that. But this is a document here which illustrates it as well. This is from the unit diary of the 8th Cheshires, who were serving in Mesopotamia, what's now largely Iraq. I have a particular interest in them because my partner's grandfather served with the 8th Cheshires in Mesopotamia. This is from December 1917. Doesn't matter too much what the battle is, but basically the 8th Cheshires are in the bottom left-hand corner and they're advancing, attacking the Turks in the top right-hand corner. And if we home in, this little blue zigzag line, which you might be able to make out, is a Turkish trench. Although, actually, it isn't. Because what somebody's written on the map next to that is, these trenches were reported, but did not really exist. Which is a wonderful statement on just how difficult, you know, we find the battlefield sometimes confusing today. It can be difficult to decipher who exactly was where, but in the middle of a battle, the trenches that were there 24 hours before could have been obliterated by shellfire. Or maybe the intelligence was wrong and they were never there at all. It really gives you a sense of the challenges of the geography of the First World War. And again, I think photographs, even of the landscape today, can help us to understand some of that. This is my personal favourite. This is a letter from Hugh Trenchard, considered by many, as I'm sure you know, to be the father of the Royal Air Force. charged with setting up the first independent air force in the spring of 1918. Up until that point, the air force, of course, had largely been part of the army and the navy. And this is a letter from the spring of 1918 where he's writing to the army commander currently in charge of the Royal Flying Corps, one of the predecessor organisations of the RAF. And he starts out, until I've actually taken over from you, I wonder if you could ask these two other officers, Festing and Brooke Popham, to draw up a provisional staff for me at my new headquarters. Which sounds like a pretty anodyne request. Until you realise this poor guy who's setting up the RAF doesn't have a staff headquarters. He's literally starting with a blank sheet of paper. Well, of course he is. There's not been a Royal Air Force before. And what fascinates me, he goes on to ask for all the things he needs. And then at the end of the letter, this is an amazing sentence from a man considered to be one of the greatest military figures of the 20th century. I feel rather like a fish out of water just now and do not quite know where to start. How wonderfully honest, but this is real. And there was a big vogue, particularly in the latter part of the 20th century, to criticise the military commanders, whether it was in the Air Force or the Army or the Navy. Venus, the lions led by donkeys theory, all these idiots leading the armed forces didn't know what they were doing. And certainly there were some very poor military decisions made. But actually, a lot of these guys were learning on the job. It was new. They didn't know what to do, and they were all a good deal more intelligent than I am. And they were struggling to actually work out what best to do. And this is a really vivid and honest example of a very capable military commander saying, I'm just kind of finding my feet here. The tragedy of the First World War is that that learning, of course, is measured in the cost of human lives. So let me show you some pictures. This is a picture that I took out on the Western Front last year in France, next to one of the largest French military cemeteries, basically in the middle of a battlefield. It's a very peaceful, tranquil scene in this sort of dawn setting, at stark odds with what it must have been like 100 or so years ago. And it always reminds me of a book which I read very early on in my research for the project called Still Quiet on the Western Front. Now, it's not to be confused with the much, much more famous All Quiet on the Western Front, which many of you will probably have read by Eric Remarque. This is written by an American, a man called Gene Smith. It's written in 1964, which for those of you astute at maths will work out was the 50th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War. And what he does is he goes to the Western Front in France and Belgium and he travels along it, along the old trench lines, and he writes about his experiences. And of course, back then, he's talking to people that lived through it. They're still living there. But he doesn't go on his own. He takes with him a photographer, a man called Peter Masefield. And what Peter Masefield does is he looks for pictures from 1914 to 1918 and tries to recreate them in 1964. Here's an example. This is 1914 or thereabouts. This is the Northumberland Hussars arriving in the square at Ypres in Belgium, coming through on their horses with the local townspeople looking at them, presumably hoping that these are going to be the guys that are going to hold the Germans back. So Peter Masefield goes in 1964 with Gene Smith and takes the same picture. And here it is. Well, the Northumberland Hussars have gone, obviously. The cars are definitely 1960s and not 1910s. But other than that, the square looks pretty much exactly the same as it did before. Now, I can't show you the 100-year picture because we're not there yet. So you have to take the 99-year picture. This is the one I took from the same spot last year, 2013. Well, different cars again. 21st century health and safety has crept in. We've got the little pedestrian bollards. But again, the background is exactly the same. And those three pictures taken together, I think, tell a remarkable story of continuity and resilience over 100 years. Way. Ypres was completely shelled and destroyed during the course of the First World War. And there were people internationally, including our very own Winston Churchill, who said Ypres should be left like this as a memorial to the destructive power of war, which in some ways is quite a nice idea. Not, however, if you're one of the former citizens of Ypres who said, no, thank you, we'd like our town back. But when they rebuilt it brick by brick, the same as it was in 1914. And when looked at in that light, I think those previous three pictures tell an even more remarkable story of resurgence and resilience in the post-war period. That's all well and good if you've got historical pictures to compare things to. What if you haven't? Well, let me show you another little combination of pictures which retell a story we probably all think we know quite well, but in a slightly different way. So if you've been, you'll almost certainly have been here to Ypres, to the Menin Gate. It's familiar to those of you that have visited. The last post ceremony each night at 8 o'clock, sounded by buglers under the Menin Gate. It's the memorial to around about 55,500 British and Commonwealth troops who were killed in the area around Ypres and whose bodies were never found. It's a memorial to the missing. This is just one of the panels from within it, with these huge lists of names. Every one of these men, of course, a son, perhaps a brother, perhaps a husband or father, and all with their own story to tell. I'm going to pick out just one. Again, you won't be able to read it, but I'll point him out to you. Lieutenant Alexis Helmer of the Canadian Artillery. Why have I picked him out? Well, let me tell you Helmer's story. May 1915, 1st of May, height of the Second Battle of Ypres, Helmer goes out to check on one of his gun batteries and is killed instantly by an enemy shell. News of his death is taken to one of his close friends, a man called John McCrae, who was a Canadian Army surgeon working here. It's a dressing station, a first aid post, just outside the town of Ypres. And this is literally where McCrae was working when he was brought news of his friend Helmer's death. And he was so moved by the death of Helmer and by the death of course, many other of his comrades that he wrote a poem. A poem which has since become very famous. You'll almost certainly know it. It's called In Flanders Fields. And it begins, "In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place." And about 100 yards from this dressing station today, there's a memorial to John McCrae. It's not to the date he died, it's to the date he wrote that poem, the 3rd of May, 1915, 2 days after his friend Helmer's death. After the war, an American politician was trying to decide what she could do to raise money for American veterans returning home injured from the First World War. And inspired by McCrae's poem, which she loved, she started to sell poppies. And it is largely as a result of her decision and of the relationship between these two men, the friendship that they had, and the poem which it created, that we owe the poppy as the symbol of remembrance today. And its story is told, written, both in the landscape and in the memorials of this little section of the Belgian countryside. Now, again, if you've been to the Western Front, another picture here of the Menin Gate, you'll also probably have been to the Great Arch at Thiepval, which is the equivalent memorial on the Somme, around 70,000 British and Commonwealth troops who were missing. And of course, it's right that we go and visit and remember at these vast memorials, which give us a huge sense of the scale of the war. But sometimes I think it's important to go off the beaten track a little. This is roughly a map of the Western Front. It moved about a bit, obviously, during the 4 years of war. It stretches right from the North Sea coast, straight down through Flanders and northern France, then it curves across to come through the Champagne region, loops round Verdun and carries on down to the Swiss border, about 450 miles in length. Continuous, more or less continuous lines of trenches. I've travelled so far about 3,000 miles up and down it taking photographs, and I've barely scratched the surface of what there is to see. When we go as British visitors, we tend to go to the top part because that's where the British troops fought. Ypres is up here, and this is the Somme area down here. We tend not to visit the bottom part so much. So I'm going to take you right down to the very, very bottom of this map, to a little village called Jonchery on the Swiss border. Here's a picture of it from the 1920s. It's a bit fuzzy, but you can see there's a house in the background, there's a road running in front of it, and a little memorial just to the left-hand side of the picture. Here it is today, same house, same road, different memorial. It was blown up in the Second World War and replaced, but it's still in the same place. Why have I brought you to this tiny little village? Well, the clue lies in the inscription on the memorial. My French is not superb, but I will do a rough translation. It says something like, "Here, on Sunday the 2nd of August 1914, Corporal Jules-André Pergeot of the 44th Regiment of Infantry was killed." Other than the name Pergeot, which as far as I'm aware has no link to the car company, does anyone notice anything odd about that inscription?
The date.
Indeed, the date. 2nd of August is before France and Germany declared war. We, of course, went to war on the 4th of August, very end of the 4th of August. The French and the Germans went to war on the 3rd. This man was killed 36 hours or so before the outbreak of hostilities. Here's the story. Of course, although war hadn't broken out, everyone knew it was coming. Pergeot and all his friends were mobilising to go and join their units. While he was mobilising, one of the girls in the house went out across the road to fetch some water from the well. And as she did so, she saw a little scouting party of Prussian cavalry galloping across the fields. So naturally she screams, possibly drops her water bottle, who knows, and runs back to the house. Peugeot and his friends run into the street. Gunfire is exchanged. The Germans retreat, but before they do so, there are two casualties. Corporal Peugeot is killed, and so too is Lieutenant Mayer from the German forces. These two men are laid out in the village barn in Jean Charest on the night of the 2nd of August 1914, side by side. These are the first two casualties of the Western Front, the first in a long line of tens and hundreds of thousands of men who will be killed or wounded. And to me, this is one of the most poignant places on the Western Front to visit. I'm very lucky in that this year I've been invited back to Jean Charest for the 100th centenary commemoration service, which they're holding in Jean Charest for the death of both of these men, both the Frenchman and the German soldier who died. I suspect that will be a very poignant occasion. It's not all about memorials, though. I've talked about battlefields. You can see here, this picture shows you the geography. This is the Champagne region. This is right in the middle of that 450-mile-long battlefront. Two things, I think, strike me about this photograph in terms of understanding the military history of the war. The first is, you can see we're on a slight hill. It's not much of a hill, but it is a slight hill. We're looking down. And actually, in the landscape of many of the areas where the battles were fought, even slight inclines could be huge strategic advantages. And it is not unusual to read of hundreds or thousands of men being killed to take slight slopes like this. And indeed, that's what happened here. There's an American memorial on the top of this hill, huge American loss of life in actually taking this high ground. But think also, if you're the French or American forces at the back of the picture advancing up the hill, look how exposed that landscape is. And bear in mind, there'd be no trees left then. They'd all have been obliterated. To assault a superior position across that sort of open landscape, you start to get an idea of the challenges which both the men and the commanders were facing in working out how to fight this very new type of warfare. That's not, of course, how we tend to think of battlefields. If we think of battlefields, we tend to think of this. This is Ypres in 1917, the mud, the shell holes, the duckboard snaking across the wasted landscape. And certainly that's part of the story. This is some preserved trenches in much the same area of the battlefront. And you can see how primitive they are. They're just literally dug into the mud. They've filled in over the last 100 years. They'd have been deeper than this originally. But they're shored up just with basic corrugated metal. And you can imagine that close to the water table, that's going to get muddy and unpleasant pretty quickly. And as in terms of our British history, this is what we think of as trench warfare. But not all trench warfare was like this. This is a very different kind of trench warfare. This picture looks rather like a woodland path climbing up through the mountains, which is what it is, but it's also a trench. It's a trench carved out of rock. It's right back down the bottom of the Western Front in the Vosges Mountains, where the French were fighting the Germans. Here you can see an even clearer picture. The parapet on the trench on the left is constructed out of stone. These are incredibly well-preserved trenches, which is why they are so interesting to visit. This is the German frontline trench. Do you see this little sign over here on the tree? That's the French frontline trench. These guys are about the width of this room apart. So you're living, 30, 40 yards away from men who are trying to kill you. You can smell what they're cooking. You can hear what they're talking about. You may not understand it, it's in a different language. But you're living week after week, month after month, in that sort of close proximity. And when you do mount an attack, this is what the French were advancing up. That's not an exaggeration, there were literally trench lines going down that mountainside. It's not quite vertical, but it's not going to be an easy landscape to advance up. A very, very different sort of trench warfare from the flat plains of Flanders or the chalky rolling hills of the Somme. But nonetheless, a very real part of the history, and until you visit it, you don't really begin to appreciate some of the challenges which are associated with it. Now, when I go away and take photographs, I usually take a friend with me to drive me around and keep me company, and I have very patient friends, but they're not all as interested in First World War history as I am. So I usually try and make sure that somewhere in the 4 or 5 days we're away, there's a half day where they choose what we do, and we go and do something completely different. So last year, I was away with a friend, and he decided he wanted to go and see the Imperial Palace at Compiègne. This was built by the French royal family before they had their heads chopped off. It was taken over by Napoleon and his successors. So a long way before the First World War, quite safe, or so we thought. Until we got there, and it very quickly became apparent that the Imperial Palace at Compiègne had been used as an Allied headquarters during the war. So there I am with my camera, the day of non-First World War history has gone out the window, and I took a picture of this room, which is the ballroom, very grand. Beautiful chandeliers, amazing pillars. You can imagine the sorts of dances that would have gone on here in the Napoleonic era. But there's something slightly strange about the picture if you look at the floor. There's two tram lines worn up and down it. You see. Now, I'm not a ballroom dancer, but I know you don't dance up and down in a straight line like that. A ballroom floor would wear very differently. But imagine three rows of beds, one down each wall and one down the middle. This room was used as a military hospital during the First World War. Now, I've not been able to prove this yet because I've not found a picture of this room from the First World War, but I'm betting that this was the paths that the doctors and the nurses trod up and down the beds between the men who were recovering in the military hospital at Compiègne. So often in unexpected places, you find really unexpected stories. That's one place where you feel very much like you're walking in the footsteps of history. This is another, quite different, very simple. Just behind the British lines at Ypres is a place called Poppering. It's a tiny town before the war, about 10,000 population. Within a few months, it had grown to 250,000 with the influx of troops. That's like going from a sleepy English country town to Nottingham more or less overnight, so heaven knows what the locals made of it. But anyway, the troops were stationed here behind the lines. This is where they came to rest or to wait to go up to the front. And an army chaplain, a man named Clayton, set up a place called Talbot House, a place where British troops, irrespective of rank, could come and have a little bit of time to relax and a little bit of a taste of home. And up in the attic here of the house is a little chapel. It's very simple, just plain benches. The altar is made out of an old workbench they found in the back garden in a shed. And you climb up a very, very steep set of attic stairs to get there. But I tell you, as you climb up those stairs, you really do feel like you're walking in the footsteps of history. How many thousands of men must have climbed up those stairs, perhaps to pray, perhaps just for a few moments' reflection, before heading back up to the front at Ypres and all that that held in store. It's almost impossible to get a photograph which does this place justice, but I think at least this speaks of its simplicity and of some of the atmosphere which is to be found there. It was a world war, of course. And we tend to forget people of all nations and all religions. This is a French cemetery with a Latin cross back to back with a Muslim headstone, probably a North African soldier fighting with the French forces. Not much light relief in this talk, I'm afraid, but this is the closest we get to a bit of light relief, a memorial to pigeons. We tend to think of the First World War as a very modern war with artillery and radio signalling and all sorts of things, but actually pigeons were still used to transmit messages. The technology was still in very, very early stages. Telephones were used, but a single shell could knock out your telephone cables. So pigeons were used to transmit signals backwards and forwards. And this is a memorial to a particular pigeon, which flew the last message back from one of the outposts of the French fort of Verdun to the headquarters back in the town, which may not sound like much of an achievement, but of course this pigeon was flying through shell fire and machine gun fire and goodness knows what else, and somehow made it back. And they put a memorial up to it afterwards. So all sorts of unexpected stories. Not all unexpected stories, however, are true. There are many myths which have emerged in relation to the First World War. This picture shows the canal at Mons. Mons, of course, where the British Expeditionary Force first came face to face with the Germans in August of 1914. And this canal was one of the strategic features they fought over. They did hold the Germans back for a little while, but not for long, and it was, British were driven back. It was a grim time. So a few weeks later, a journalist wrote a short story, a fictional short story, to try and stir people's spirits a bit. He called it The Bowman, and it was published in what I think was basically the forerunner of the London Evening Standard. It's a very short story, only about 3 or 4 pages long. And in it, he describes the British taking on the Germans at Mons. And at a crucial moment, there's clouds part above the British troops, and there are Henry V's bowmen from the Battle of Agincourt firing arrows at the Germans and helping the British hold them back. It's a bit of patriotic fervour to try and rally British spirits at a time when they were low. Machen was horrified when he realised a few weeks later that some people thought this story was true. He'd never intended it to be. It was always a work of fiction. But some people thought it was really true. And reports started to come back from the front line of men who had seen figures in the air above them. The Angel of Mons myth was born. And it's a fascinating... I mean, it's quite humorous now and it sounds quite ridiculous, but actually it's a fascinating insight into the level of patriotism, the sense of duty, and also the sense of a religious or spiritual belief, which is really largely lacking in our society today. It's one of the big contrasts between where we are now and where we were 100 years ago. Not everything about Mons is a myth, though. This is a fascinating little picture which tells a story in its own right. This rather sad-looking bollard in the foreground is the first Schott's Memorial, just outside Mons, about a couple of miles from that canal I just showed you. This is where British troops first exchanged fire with German troops in August 1914. Just up the road, there's a restaurant, that big yellow building, and it's got an arched window in it with a rather unattractive pink sign. Just beneath that window, there's a plaque. That plaque is the last Schott's Memorial. That is where Canadian troops exchanged the final fire with Germans in November of 1918. Now, of course, in the intervening period, the battlefront had ranged over a much wider distance than that. But as a sort of bitter, ironic reflection on how little territory actually changed hands in some parts of the Western Front over that four and a half year period, I don't think images come much more starkly than that. I've said it's not all about cemeteries and memorials, but I'm going to talk a little bit, very briefly, about cemeteries because I think they give us an interesting insight into approaches to remembrance. This is what most of us probably think of as a First World War cemetery, managed by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. They brought in the leading architects of the day, people like Lutyens, who designed the cenotaph, Kipling to advise on the wording, Gertrude Jekyll, the garden designer, to advise on the planting. So we have Commonwealth War Grave cemeteries, which look like English country gardens, very restful, very beautiful places. Not all First World War cemeteries are like that. And this is an example of a German cemetery on the left-hand side with plain black crosses, each cross marking four burials, two names on the front and two on the reverse. The Germans, of course, given much less land to bury their dead after the war and had much less money. The one on the right is actually a French cemetery. Which, although the French were victors in the war, still a very plain, understated cemetery. Concrete crosses, very little planting. It's very interesting the different approaches which different nations take to memorialisation. The French approach is much, much starker than the British, in my view at least. This is one of their memorials. It's interesting, we call our memorials war memorials. The French call them monuments aux morts, monuments to the dead. Much more, you know, blunt. That's what it is. And this is a case in point. This shows the corpse of a French soldier carrying in one hand his battle standard and in the other wrapping himself up in his own funeral shroud. But nowhere, I think, is the French stark approach to death and commemoration more crisply encapsulated than here. At Douaumont, just outside Verdun. Verdun, the longest single battle of the First World War, Verdun to the French, really what the Somme is to the British. Hundreds of thousands of French and German soldiers killed in the battle around Verdun. What I want to draw your attention to is not actually the cemetery, it's the big Art Deco building in the background, which is an ossuary, a bone store. Piled up in the basement of that building are the bones of 100,000 men of both sides, German and French, who lost their lives around Verdun. Of course, we're not talking complete bodies, we're talking about fragments. Still being added to today as farmers plough up their fields. And I know this because in the basement there are windows through which you can look at those remains. It is absolutely shocking and a very startling reminder of the human cost of the First World War. You will be relieved to know I have not taken a picture of that. I actually felt that kind of crossed a boundary between respect and disrespect. It's one thing to look, it's another to photograph. And if I can risk being slightly pretentious for a moment, I'm very conscious of this issue of respect in the project that I'm putting together. There are an awful lot of very more able, capable and famous artists who've gone before me who have tried to create art out of remembrance, whether it's the war poets of the time or the sculptors that did the memorials after the war or playwrights or whatever. And I try to make sure that each picture I take is done with a sense of respect. And this is one which I felt I needed to approach particularly carefully. This is taken at Loch Na Garr. It's a large crater on the Somme battlefield. The British blew it up underneath the German lines on the 1st of July 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. It is vast. And next to it has now been erected a very simple plain cross, because, of course, this is still a graveyard. I mean, they've never recovered all of the German bodies. About 400 feet of German front line completely obliterated in this area. I mentioned some of the sculptors and others working. I'm just going to pick out one post-First World War sculptor. This is work by a man called Charles Sargent Jagger. He fought in the First World War, he survived, and as he was a sculptor, he resumed his trade after the war and sculpted war memorials. This is a fascinating example. It's just outside Cambrai. And two things I think really interesting are going on here. The first is, look at the detail, the folds in the clothes of those soldiers, the detail of the equipment which they're carrying. Incredibly realistic. But at the same time, all three soldiers' faces are masked, either because they're turning away from you or they're hidden. This piece of relief is at once very realistic, but also very generic. It could be any soldier. It could stand for anyone. And I think that's one of the huge pieces of skill which Jagger shows as a memorial architect. And there's a lot of his work. You don't have to go to France or Belgium to see it. If you've ever been to Hyde Park Corner and looked at the artillery memorial just outside the Duke of Wellington's house, that's Jagger's work as well. So too is the very famous war memorial at Paddington Station of the soldier reading a letter. All very, very striking memorial architecture. This brings us to the end of the First World War. This is the site of the signing of the armistice at Compiègne. This stone slab marks where Ferdinand Foch, the commander-in-chief of the Allied forces at the end of the war, had his railway carriage. And this is where the Germans' delegation was brought at 5 o'clock on the 11th of November 1918. Good pub quiz question, actually, if you ever want one. When was the armistice of the First World War signed? Most people will say 11 o'clock on the 11th of November. That's when it came into force. It was actually signed around about 5 o'clock in the morning on the 11th of November 1918, and this is where it happened. Let me bring it all back to Kew, because that's where we are, and back to the archives. I've already talked a little bit about some of the documents which have particularly influenced me in the work so far. I'm now going to show you three more, which are really going to help shape the work moving forward. And hopefully it'll become clear why as I show them to you. This is a fascinating document from the 245th Machine Gun Company's unit diary from March and April of 1918. Now, without beginning a long diatribe on First World War history, in the spring of 1918, as many of you will know, the Germans launched their last big offensive on the Western Front in an attempt to defeat the Allies before the American troops really arrived in force. And right down the middle of this map, you can probably see there's a long straight line. That's an old Roman road. That was one of their main axes of advance. So they're coming from that side to this side, and the Allies, the British and the Australians and others, are trying to hold them back. Not very successfully. In the space of a few days, the Germans managed to advance about 50 miles, which in First World War terms is a huge military advance. What this document, this map, shows us is the retreat of the 245th Machine Gun Company, not just day by day, but hour by hour and minute by minute during that period, March to April 1918. Marked on the map are their positions on different days and at different times. And for someone trying to document in photographs the events 100 years on, to look at the same landscape now, this is an incredibly powerful tool. What I aim to do in the spring of 1918 is to go and retrace their steps. And by using this map, I can literally pinpoint to the hour and more or less to the minute where they were 100 years ago. And to tell something of the story of the geographical, the historical, the military and the political challenges which they must have faced during that very, very difficult period of the fighting. As you all know, as users of the archives, one of the great strengths of TNA is being able to link up documents here with documents that maybe are held elsewhere. And I've been doing a lot of work with the RAF Museum up in Hendon, looking at the papers of one particular man, a man called Bernard Rice, who's a young man, joined up at the beginning of the war, joined the Army Service Corps, and then joined the Royal Flying Corps, and finally the RAF. And he was a prolific writer. He wrote home largely to his father, often several times a week. And I have been reading, cataloguing, and indexing his letters, which are absolutely fascinating. On the 9th of March 1917, he's just gone back to France from a period of leave, and he writes his first letter back home to his dad. And he describes a very daring mission in which he flew over enemy lines, helping the artillery to accurately shell a German railhead where railway engines were coming to supply the German troops. And he describes vividly in this letter how he, very dangerous mission, he helps the artillery, they shell the railhead, and he sees three railway engines scuttling away from this area which he's been shelling. So that's in his letter. He doesn't say where he is, of course, because he can't, it would have been censored, and he gives a very personal account. Well, I happen to know from his papers that he was in the 8th Squadron of the Royal Flying Corps at that time, so I'm able, here at the National Archives, to dig out the 8th Squadron logbook, which, for the date in question, gives the precise details of Bernard Rice's mission. It tells us which siege battery he was working with. It gives us a map grid reference for exactly where the shelling was taking place. It even tells us how far off target each of those rounds fell. And then it confirms that, yes, indeed, three engines were observed to steam off in an easterly direction, which is slightly more RFC speak than three engines scuttled away, which is what Bernard says in his letter. But there it is. And the next stage, of course, which we haven't done yet, is to find the trench maps and to find out exactly what that grid reference means. And then again, we can pinpoint the exact spot that was being shelled by Bernard Rice and this 239th Siege Battery on that date at the beginning of March 1917. Finally, I've mentioned working with respect. One of the biggest challenges, one of many challenges, but one that's big in my mind, is if I'm going to photograph at the centenary of the First World War, what do I photograph at 11 o'clock on the 11th of November 2018? I can only be in one place. What place could possibly sum up the armistice at the end of the First World War? I don't have an answer to that question yet. But I think one of the reasons it's so complex is encapsulated in this document. This is the 50th Battalion Machine Gun Corps unit diary from November 1918. 10th of November, it records some troop movements. 11th of November, it records some troop movements. And then it simply says, cessation of hostilities at 11. The next entry is for the 12th of November, which is some more troop movements. Now, these documents are not necessarily going to be particularly effusive in their descriptions of what's happening. They're regimental diaries, but you might have expected a little bit more than cessation of hostilities at 11. But actually, if you look back at the individual accounts that soldiers on the Western Front write about the armistice, it is not universal jumping around and shouting and partying. It is often very sombre, very reflective. One is not quite sure what to make of it all. And for me, one of the big challenges of 11th of November 2018 is somehow taking a picture which respects that spectrum of responses which people felt. Yes, there was celebration in the streets in London, of course there was, but that wasn't universal. And that's, fortunately, I've still got another 4 years to work that one out, but that will be a big challenge. Any suggestions, very welcome, by the way. As I said at the beginning, one of the things I'm really keen to do with this project is to get out and share these pictures with people. So if you know of any groups or organisations that might be interested in having a talk a bit like this one, or a workshop or something a bit more interactive, history groups, camera groups, school groups, retirement groups, I don't know, anything, then please, please do put them in touch with me. One final story, though. I'm not sure if you're really allowed to have a favourite First World War memorial. It doesn't seem quite the right thing to do. But if I was allowed to have one, one of the prime candidates would be this one. This is the Canadian Memorial at Vimy Ridge. Vimy Ridge, as its name suggests, is an area of high ground taken by the Germans at the very beginning of the war in 1914. The subject of many Allied attempts to try and retake it, finally retaken with a significant Canadian involvement in the spring of 1917. And so after the war, the Canadians decided to erect their monument here. And it's difficult to get a sense of scale, but you can get the rough idea. It's huge. It's vast on this ridge overlooking the plains below. Now, last year, I was out on the Western Front taking some photographs for this project, and we were staying not a million miles from Vimy Ridge, and we'd had an early supper, and the sun was starting to go down, and we were trying to decide what we were going to do with our evening, and we said, well, why don't we head up to Vimy Ridge and see what it looks like in the sunset, because it might look rather special in the sunset glow. We've got nothing else to do. So with my friend, off we head. Now, the only way we could get from where we'd had dinner to where this memorial was to go down the motorway, right past the memorial, onto the next junction, off at a roundabout, and then up these wretched little winding hillside roads to get to the top of the ridge. So off we set, and as we drive past the memorial on the motorway, I look across, and there it is, bathed in the most magnificent golden sunset glow, looking stunning. But of course, we're on the motorway, so we can't stop. And even if we could, it's far too far away to get a decent picture. So we've no choice but to head on to this next junction, off at the roundabout, up these winding little hillside roads. And all the time I'm thinking, by the time we get there, it's all going to have gone. The sun's going to have set, or the angle of the light's going to have changed, and it's going to be a disaster. So we pull up outside. I still can't see the thing because it's behind the trees. I'm bundled out of the car with my tripod and my camera. I race through the gate, up the path, through the trees, plonk my tripod down, set my camera up, take the picture, and mercifully, it was still in the glorious sunset glow. If anything, it had actually intensified. And when I'd taken the picture, I then sort of relaxed. I thought, I've got my picture. And I stopped, and I realised that there wasn't a single other living soul there. This is one of the most visited monuments on the Western Front. To have it to yourself is almost unheard of, but I did. My friend was still off parking the car, so I took a bit of time just to reflect on what had happened there and on the thousands of men of both sides who had lost their lives fighting over this ridge of ground. And then over the next 30 minutes or so, gradually the light changed and I stayed and took more photographs. The sunset intensified, eventually turned into a beautiful blue, dusky light, and finally turned to night. And we were left just with the figure, this is Mother Canada, looking out over the twinkling lights of the plain down below. There's an awful lot of talk in the media about what the centenary of the First World War should be about. Should it be about victory? Should it be about European integration? Should it be about peace? Should it be about educating young people? I've got no axe to grind with this project about what remembrance should be about. But for me, if I can just encourage people to take a few moments, as I did at Vimy Ridge, to reflect and to work out for themselves what remembrance ought to be about 100 years on, then I'll consider it a job well done and a worthwhile project. Thank you very much indeed for your attention. I'll be very happy to take any questions.
This talk was sponsored by the Friends of the National Archives. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.